7.
Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. Looking back at the that last segment, it is a bit of a shame that I didn't spend the little bit of time we had left continuing to focus on the letter that had been written by the Iraqi Afghan veteran, the story of his brother, the story of his journey, his realization that there is an irresolvable conflict between what Paul wrote and what God had to say in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. All of that promotes such deep inspection and contemplation that I really had wished I had just stayed on that topic. It is important that we consistently convey what he found to be true, that it is impossible to reconcile Paul's letters with God's testimony. One of the two of them is absolutely lying. I am spending most of my time now rewriting Questioning Paul. I'm just now through the sixth chapter in my review, but two of the individuals who are helping me with that edit, I think, are just now through chapter 4. So it's 12 chapters, so there's a ways to go, but it is being profoundly changed making a much stronger argument than the one that already was contained in the text. Paul was probably the most influential man who ever lived. I don't think there's any question that Paul was more influential than Moshe in his role of revealing the Torah, nor was he more influential than Yosha with his life. Paul was the single most influential man that ever lived. Now, that's not good. I give that title to Paul, much like Time magazine would give the title of Man of the Year, not recognizing whether that individual was doing something that was worthy and noble and good, or just influencing the world for horrible reasons and actually causing it to be less desirable. In the case of Paul, he was had the greatest negative influence on humanity of anyone who has ever lived, far more so than Muhammad. The other thing that he mentioned, it is one of the reasons why I recognize there was no chance that we could prevail in Afghanistan and Iraq. And normally I wouldn't care during the second hour that the American government was deceiving us, that the media was in cohorts with the government in terms of running this propagandist, patriotic deception. But it is true that we had no chance to prevail in that war or any war, because the United States has decided that the only way it can get Americans to pull triggers and kill people is to make them think that they are vastly superior, kind of like Adolf Hitler did with the Aryan race, kind of like what Muhammad did with his Arab Muslims, that they are superior and that the world belongs to them, and that those they kill are the lowest form of life that their God himself hates and wants to eradicate, and so that by killing these scum, you're actually doing the world and your God a favor. It is the indoctrination of the U.S. military. It is the indoctrination of patriotism that we do these heinous things. It's why the American president can murder 4,000 people with drones, and no one criticizes him for it. In fact, it's considered a good thing that he is keeping America safe by going off and killing people who have never done anything harmful to America with drones, killing women and children along with it, collateral damage, as they would say. This kind of dehumanization, this kind of indoctrination, making the practice of killing good, is part of the corruption of the very fabric of our society. And lastly, on this issue with Satan and his brother, the Hasatan is a very real individual. How many demons he has with him, these would be fallen messengers, don't know. But recognize that that anyone who is not part of God's covenant, which would be one in a million people, are susceptible to them. Now, they are not omnipresent. That means they can't be in one place at every place at the same time. And so most of the things that are attributed to them are untrue. But they can, in fact, possess individuals. Muhammad was demon-possessed. Paul was demon-possessed. This man's brother appears to be demon-possessed. It can happen. And the first thing that the demon's going to want to do is to want that individual to die, wants to have that individual soul. And so there is only one remedy for this. It's the Torah. Now, the Torah doesn't speak of how you rid specifically a possessed individual of a demon, because it doesn't have to. What the Torah says is, where there is light, there is no darkness. It says that the Torah is light. It says that Yahweh is light. In the presence of light, darkness isn't hidden. It's obliterated. And so the answer is the Torah. The answer is Yahweh. That is the answer. And so that's why God didn't have to say, if you see a demon-possessed individual, this is what you do, this is what you say, this is how you respond. Because all you need to know is where the Torah is, where Yahweh is, Satan is powerless. These things known, let's now return to the Barashith, Torah. We were considering the fourth day, and I would like to share with you some insights regarding the fourth day. Here's the text from God himself. God said, let there be lights, luminaries, ma'or, in the expanse of the heavens to divide day from night, and let them exist as symbols and signs, oath, for the appointed meetings, moed, for days and for years. They exist as lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light for the earth existing and established. God fashioned the two large luminaries, the greater luminary, to rule over the day, the light, and the lesser luminary, the one of lower status, meaning less important, insignificant, opposed and abhorred, to govern the night. God established the expanse of the heavens for light upon the earth to rule over, to have dominion over the day, and the night to divide and separate light from darkness. God saw that it was good. This is the explanation as to how you would deal, my friend. I hope you listen to this archive after work today. It is how you deal with the darkness that is demon possession. Expose that darkness to light. Now, the thing that we were talking about, because we have spent two programs talking about the spiritual implications of this, I wanted to share now some more insights regarding the chronological implications of this. And to remind our newer listeners, there are three stories being told in one account with creation. It is an exacting, scientifically accurate explanation of how and when God created the universe, and how and when and even why he authored life within it. The story that God presents is correct from a timeline perspective, and it is correct from the chronology of events that are presented, and it is correct from the content and the descriptions of each day. But it's more than that. It is future human history. It's history about the things that God cares about most. Within each of these 6 days, including even the conclusion of the seventh, God is telling us of what would be the seminal event of the 6,000 years as they would transpire from the time Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden to the time not only that he returns at the end of the sixth day, to the celebration of us returning to the Garden of Eden conditions during the seventh day, each day representing 1,000 years. So while the universe and life on this planet is billions of years old, as is consistent with the relative nature of time and the story of creation being told by the Creator present at creation. The story of humanity with a nesama, with a conscience, with that which enables us to exercise good judgment, to come to know and understand God, appreciating what He is offering. That story is just shy of 6,000 years old. Now, in that this is amongst the most important predictions in all of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, this timeline that is being presented by God, and the first of countless prophecies regarding specifically the redemptive mission of Yahweh's human manifestation, Yahusha. Let's linger here a while longer and consider what can be gleaned from the historical record, because God, in saying in the fourth day, is that the greater light is going to be revealed to us as a sign. Yahusha, the Messiah, is going to be seen by us as a sign in this fourth day. That's what he's saying here. And so it's important to know from the historical record if we can ascribe the arrival of the Messiah within the fourth day of human history, recognizing that everything that God has done up to this point relative to this timeline has designated the last possible moment within that 1,000 years to accomplish his goal. And so the end of year 4,000 Yah, which would be the end of the fourth day, transpires on our pagan calendars at 33 CE. So, if we're looking at the arrival of the Messiah, he has to arrive before then, and his primary mission must be completed by no later than that date, 4,000 Yah, which is 33 CE on our pagan calendars. Now, the year of Yahusha's arrival is broadly believed by biblical scholars to be 4 BCE, and that is because in Matanyah, Matthew says that it occurred during the reign of King Herod. However, scholarly extrapolation is based upon an erroneous interpretation of Josephus's report of an eclipse, which turned out only to be a partial eclipse, now that we're able to go back and look at the astronomical alignment. The eclipse of 4 BCE was a partial eclipse. It occurred on March 13th, 4 BCE, which was the wrong time of year. Yahusha arrived on Tabernacles, which is in the seventh month of the year. Now, we will return to our discussion in a moment when Shattering Myths continues after the break. Returning to Shattering Myths, we were considering the story that Josephus wrote about the eclipse in 4 BCE, which occurred on March 13th, 4 BCE, and that is the eclipse that that Josephus said shortly before that Herod died, not thinking anything beyond that. Biblical scholars say that, okay, that means that the man whose name they do not know, their Jesus Christ, had to be born on in 4 BCE. You know, first of all, God wasn't born. It was a child was born unto us. A son was given to us is the explanation. But turns out it was only a partial eclipse, and partial eclipses are so common, it would never have been used as the reference. There are a number of problems with this accounting, in addition to the fact that it conflicts with Scripture and Josephus was a traitor who shouldn't be trusted. But more to the point, the total eclipse visible, and the only total eclipse visible in the region during this period, actually occurred on January 1st, 1 CE. Not only was that event worth noting, it provided sufficient time between Yahusha's arrival on the Mikra of Sukkah on Tabernacles, Yahochanan, pointed this out to us, that he tabernacled with us. He arrived on Tabernacles. Tabernacles is, of course, the day he has to arrive. Tabernacles means camp out with God, God camping out with us. So he arrived on Tabernacles, and he actually arrived on Tabernacles in the fall of 2 BCE. Herod's death occurring in 1 CE. Now you'd say, well, that's a 3 years distance. No, it isn't, because there was no year zero, and we're talking about 1 CE, and we're talking about the fall of 2 BCE. So it's as close as you could come to the timing of the death of Herod. Now, speaking of this, we know that this that his arrival required his family to flee to Egypt to avoid the king's paranoid persecution, which occurred in that 1 year period between the fall of 2 BCE and during 1 BCE when the persecution occurred, thus harmonizing the accounts. Since details are important to Yah, since any deviation from the truth in Scripture would be devastating to its veracity, and since the prophecy depicted in the fourth day of creation is stunningly important relative to God's prophetic timeline, let's see if we can determine when Herod the Great actually died, and thus confirm when Yahusha arrived in our world. Now, but before we proceed, a word of caution. Since Yahusha has always existed, at least he has existed as a set-apart, diminished manifestation of Yahweh from the time that matter existed. Prior to that, he was just a part of Yahweh. The year of his birth is irrelevant. The thing that is important in terms of recognition of the fourth millennia is when he fulfilled the first four moed. The moed were referenced here as the sign, and therefore God is telling you, if you want to know the terminus date of the fourth millennia of human history, exile from the garden, you have to look at the moed, and he fulfilled the moed in year 33 CE, which would be year 4000 Yah. But he was 30-something years old when he began his public ministry, and he conducted his public ministry for 3 years, which is why the 2 BCE date also fits that timeline perfectly. All right. As we consider this, we have learned that for Yah's accounting to be accurate, the Messiah had to arrive in mankind's fourth millennia in accordance with the Barashith fourth day predictions, and then be around 33 years old, which is the time designated by Lucas in 323, said he was about 30 years old at the time that his public ministry began, and we have three recorded Passovers that were celebrated between then and the ultimate fulfillment of Passover in 33 CE. We know 33 CE is the terminus date because of the Daniel predictions. Daniel has him, if you do the math, walking into Jerusalem 4 days before Passover in 33 CE. Moreover, when you look at the lunar phases of the moon, it is only in 33 CE that Passover is celebrated on the day of the week that it is presented in the eyewitness accounts, because we have a story about Passover and then the Shabbat, which would be the Shabbat of Matzah, and then the first day of the week, which was a celebration of first fruits. And so the only year within 3 years prior and 3 years after 33 CE that this could have occurred is in fact in 33 CE, which was the Yobel year, which was exactly year 4000 Yah. We'll return to this story when Shattering Myths continues in a moment. Come back to Shattering Myths. Before we continue with the timeline and try to calibrate our calendar to Yahweh's calendar, we have Tony, who's called in from the state of Missouri. I know it is Missouri, but my father was born in that state and always said that he was born in Missouri and was never able to leave the place. Hello, Tony. I understand that you have a couple of questions, the first on demon possession and the second on the nature of the and the origin of the Hebrew language.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. And
sure, Connie.
I apologize for interrupting your topic because it's a fascinating topic.
You know, the nice thing about this topic, Tony, is that when we return to our program tomorrow, we're going to resume right here on this topic. So there is no problem whatsoever with either of your questions because both of your questions are really on the overall topic.
Well, good. Well, first off, I'll just relate an experience I had with someone who was demon possessed.
Please.
A young teenager from another state that went to a big Christian conference with me a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
Just a gigantic, you know, 20,000 people all worshiping Jesus.
Yeah.
And this kid was involved in Satanism before he came to Christianity.
Yeah, no, nothing that people of faith like more than being surrounded by lots of people that believe the same thing they do.
Yeah. So anyhow, in the middle of this conference, and they were all worshiping one night, he started to get really sick, and he falls on the floor, and I'm right next to him, so I'm watching him. He's writhing on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
His face is starting to turn blue, and he's making satanic symbols with his with his hands.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I'm freaked out. And at this point in time in my life, mm-hmm. I was a devoted Christian. So I'm trying to cast this demon out of him.
Yes.
And I'm calling on the name of Jesus to cast the demon out.
Right.
Repeatedly. And there's other people all gathered around us trying to help this kid. And he's literally about ready to die. Because
Now imagine God. Imagine God at this point saying, "Who are you? I don't know anybody by that name, so you're obviously not talking to me." Yeah, that's nothing happened. Yeah, nothing happened. Yeah,
it just baffled me that everything that I read in my English Bible about the casting out didn't work.
Yeah, because your English Bibles are not only hugely corrupted, but most Christians only pay attention to their Christian New Testament, half of which is comprised of Paul's letters, which contradict everything that God has to say, and they actually don't want to consider anything Yahusha had to say because everything Yahusha has to say contradicts what Paul has to say, and it's just so much easier being a Christian if you only listen to Paul.
Right. Well,
and of course, Paul himself was demon possessed. So, what was the upshot of that? Is just everybody wondering why in the world their religious solution of calling in the name of Jesus wasn't working?
Well, they eventually asked us to, get out of the main area, and they took him into a private room, and they got him settled down, and he could breathe again, and they led him through a process they called deliverance, where he renounced all of his satanic agreements and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
At the end of this, he threw up a couple times and then appeared to be released from the demon.
Okay.
Later on, though, within 2 or 3 months afterwards, I was still friends with this young man.
Uh-huh.
He left Christianity and went back to basically just his life of, drugs and girls and whatever.
Right, which means that the whole charade in the back room was a farce.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. And just my question was,
yeah.
Do demons participate in the lives of Christians just to help keep promoting false realities, or why do they even attack Christians? What's the point?
First, I think that the number of occurrences of demon possession and demon involvement are probably overstated by a millionfold. I think that that since Hasatan is so limited in terms of his lack of being able to be in all places at one time, and he's put under considerable constraints by Yahweh, that he only actually influences and possesses a very, very, very small percentage of people. I mean, two people that he has done his best work through are Paul and Muhammad. And so there are individuals where you can be pretty certain that he's had a played a role, but the vast majority, I don't think it has anything to do with Satan. So I think it's a lot of times people are just sick. As it turns out, the trying to guess as to whether or not your friend actually had a demonic experience, you know, I don't know. I can tell you that when you turn to drugs and all of that sort of thing, you're actually ingesting things that are poisonous to you, and so they're just as capable of destroying your ability to think. You know, it's kind of interesting in this regard, speaking of your friend turning back to drugs. There's been a study on the murders that have taken place in schools, the shooters, and of course the president wants to take the guns away, calling guns the problem. The one commonality in 99.99% of the mass murders that have occurred in and around schools with guns is young people, usually boys, being treated with mind-altering drugs, typically antidepressant kinds of drugs and painkillers. And it is their medication and going on and off of the medication and the degree to which they use the medication that is the one common trait between all of them. So I suspect that a lot of things that are blamed on demonic experiences are really derived mostly from our willingness to drug ourselves. Anyway, you had a question on the origin of the Hebrew language.
Yeah, I was doing a little research yesterday and came across an article written by a guy. I'm not exactly sure what persuasion he was from.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps the name Yahweh in his writing, so
mm-hmm.
gives you the idea that he's, you know, maybe on the right track, maybe not.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of people that have come to know his name, who are still very much mired in Christianity or rabbinic Judaism. But before you ask that question, let me share one other thing with you, if I may. One of the things that it just popped into my head, and I just wanted to share it related to Hasatan and demonic spirits, is that the last thing Satan wants is to be known as Satan. The last thing he wants is to be seen engaging in demonic activity. The last thing he wants is to control somebody in such a way that reveals his actual nature. All Hasatan wants is to be worshipped as if he were God. He wants to be considered the Lord. He wants to be seen as God, not the adversary. That's why the Quran is written in the Christian New Testament with Satan being a bad guy. Because even though he inspired it, he wants to distance himself from the adversary mentality. And so the whole kind of writhing and pain of demon possession is opposed to Hasatan's overall desire. He wants to be seen as God. So he wants to be seen as the Lord of religion. And so you're very seldom going to see him possessing someone, causing them to do destructive behavior, because that's the opposite impression that he's trying to make.
Well, I got a question then on the role of his servant angels,
angel actually is a transliteration of a Greek word, agelos, and agelos means messenger. It is the translation of the Hebrew word malak. Malak is a spiritual envoy. It's a messenger.
Yeah, and I was always curious about the number of fallen malak.
Yeah, we don't know. We really just don't know. I don't know how many malak Yahweh has. He uses the term shaba to describe them, which we translate host. But it means that they are a large regimen. They're controlled in a command and control type of an environment. They do not have free will. And so we know that they are quite numerous. But there isn't a reason for Yahweh to give us the quantity of them, and he doesn't. So it would be it'd simply be speculating to come up with a number here. I certainly don't know. I would My inclination is that it's that it could be in the thousands, with meaning that there would be thousands that are followed Hasatan that would be clandestine and destructive, and twice that many of thousands that would still be responsive and taking their instruction from Yahweh.
There was a scripture somewhere that I read one time that talked about his Malak being in the, I think it was 10,000 times 10,000. Does that ring a bell?
It doesn't. It might be there. You know, one of the things that I'm always cautious of, and I want to make every listener be aware of, I don't claim to be the guy that has all the answers or knows everything. My only contribution is that I know where to look for answers, and that I think I'm reasonably gifted in the sense of being able to understand the story that God is presenting. So it is very possible that what you say, that it's quantified in tens of thousands upon tens of thousands, that would still fall into my kind of personal understanding that there are many thousands of them. And one of the things, by the way, is also true is that I don't even think that the loyal Malak, messengers and envoys, that I don't think they can respond to anything that we ask of them. I mean, I think that if you were to actually see one, because Yahweh wanted you to see one, and you were to ask that one question, I could absolutely answer a question. But it isn't, you know, a lot of people pray for angels to do things in their lives. They follow Yah's orders, not ours. So even with the ones that are still loyal to Yah, their job description is to follow His instructions, His orders, and in His case, with the Malak, they are orders. And so we can ask Yahweh, hey, would it be within your will to deploy them to do these things? But the one thing that He tells us that He will do with them, that He's very clear about, is that if we acknowledge Him, if we gird ourselves with His Torah teaching, if we walk in His presence and take the kind of risk that we take when we share His message, that He will defend us with His Malak. And I've to Shattering Mist. We're having a conversation with Tony, who's calling in from Missouri, and we're going to transition to Tony's second question, which was about the origin of the Hebrew language. You were beginning to present that, Tony, when I interrupted you to talk more about the nature of demons and Malak.
Well, I'll continue. I've heard you say previously that you believe that Hebrew is the language that God revealed to man, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that Hebrew will be the language in heaven. We'll speak Hebrew together, and you know, I've been fascinated by the Hebrew language since I've come to know Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
just discerning these, just the amazing qualities of it.
Yes.
Along comes an article that I read, and in the article it stated that, and I think some of it's true, that Hebrew was around a long time before the Torah was written, and that it would, and this author, this editorial actually said, mm-hmm. you know, Hebrew would have been a pagan language, pagan just meaning, you know, not a part of the covenant. it would have been a pagan language that had been around for hundreds, possibly thousands of years before Yah gave it to Moses. Or Moshe, and so that the people already knew the language, so God used the language that they already knew to give them His word, and then He kind of transitioned to say that, you know, the same thing happened when God used Greek,
yeah.
New Testament,
goodness gracious,
language of today. That's
all the nature of deceit, is you use half truths. Here are the things we know for absolute certain: that is that Hebrew is God's chosen language of revelation. We know that for absolute certain. Hebrew is the chosen language of God's revelation. We also know for certain that the alphabetic characters that comprise Hebrew, the 22 of them, the first alphabet that man has ever been able to use. So the 22 characters that comprise the Hebrew alphabet are man's first alphabet. Doesn't mean that written Hebrew was the first written language. Sanskrit is probably the first written language, but it doesn't use as an alphabet. It uses a cuneiform. And hieroglyphics, of course, use pictographs. So we know that the oldest alphabet is Hebrew. We know that Hebrew is the language of revelation. We know that Hebrew is a absolute perfect language to convey the eternal nature of God because of the unique nature of its tenses. We know, of course, that the Israelites in Egypt spoke Hebrew and understood Hebrew. Otherwise, there would have been no point in presenting the Torah to them in Hebrew. But there is every indication that the language that Yahweh spoke to Adam and he spoke to Noah was Hebrew. That does not make Hebrew a pagan language. It just makes Hebrew the language that God spoke to those he wished to have a conversation with. And it is still the language God speaks to those he wishes to have a conversation with. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that God inspired anything in the Greek language. Yahusha never spoke Greek, and there is no indication that any part of the Christian New Testament as it's recorded in Greek is inspired. In fact, we know that half of it is anti-witness. It speaks against God's Hebrew revelation to humanity, and we know the parts that aren't written by Paul are so badly corrupted is that it's just not credible. There are more discrepancies between the oldest manuscripts and our translations and their actual words. So it is just not credible. And so that's that thought process of going from Hebrew just happened to be a language to Greek just happened to be a language, therefore God inspired one versus the other is a leap without any justification whatsoever. But as I said, all we know for sure is that Hebrew is the language of heaven, and that we know for certain that Hebrew is the language that God has chosen to reveal himself to us, and that we know that even though the children of Israel spent over 400 years in Egypt, that they still understood and spoke Hebrew. Otherwise, there would have been no value in God speaking the Torah to them or providing Moshe with the Torah in writing to recite to them. That answer your question, Rod? Tony?
Yeah, it does. One question I had then real quick,
yes,
to follow up is there any evidence that Hebrew... Oh, I guess two questions. Any evidence that Hebrew existed before Adam?
I think that if, why would God need a language, I guess, to communicate with himself? I doubt it. Although God does say that he spoke the universe into existence and he spoke life into existence. And so as a result of that, he had to speak a language. The language would have been Hebrew, so perhaps the answer is yes. This is the end of our program today. Steve, come and join us tomorrow.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact that...